KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now.
Look, Elon and I had a great relationship. I don't know if we're well anymore, but I'm very disappointed in Elon. I've helped Elon a lot.
Is the Donald Trump-Elon Musk bromance over? President Trump's threatening to cut off billions of dollars in federal contracts with Musk after the two billionaires engaged in a dramatic online feud just days after Musk called Trump's budget bill a disgusting abomination. Musk appeared to back the impeachment of Trump and claimed the president is named in the Jeffrey Epstein files. We'll get the latest. Plus, we look at the deadly impact of the House budget bill.
Our analyses demonstrate that the health care retractions proposed in the current reconciliation bill would precipitate more than 51,000 unnecessary deaths annually.
We'll also speak to Newark Mayor Ross Baraka. He's filed a federal lawsuit after being arrested by masked federal agents outside an Immigration and Customs Enforcement jail in Newark. Then to a doctor suing the University of California, San Francisco. She was fired after speaking out about Gaza. Plus, we get an update from the Freedom Flotilla boat heading to Gaza.
We are now on our sixth day of our journey to break the siege of Gaza and to create a people's humanitarian corridor with the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. And this journey represents not only an attempt to end starvation of the Palestinian people, but also a solidarity mission to break the siege.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump is threatening to cut off billions of dollars in federal contracts with Elon Musk after the two engaged in an escalating online feud just days after Musk left his role as a White House advisor. Tension had been escalating since Musk, the world's richest man, called Trump's budget bill a disgusting abomination because it'll increase the federal deficit by $2.5 trillion. On Thursday, Musk threatened to decommission the Dragon spacecraft used by NASA, which would imperil astronauts aboard the International Space Station. Musk also appeared to back the impeachment of Trump and took credit for Trump winning the presidency. In one online post, he referenced Trump's friendship with the deceased convicted sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, writing, quote, "Time to drop the really big bomb. Real Donald Trump is in the Epstein files. That's the real reason they have not been made public. Have a nice day, DJT!" exclamation point, Musk wrote. Trump accused Musk of going crazy after an electric vehicle tax credit was removed from the House budget bill. In one post, Trump wrote, quote, "The easiest way to save money in our budget, billions and billions of dollars, is to terminate Elon's governmental subsidies and contracts. I was always surprised that Biden didn't do it," Trump wrote. On Thursday, shares of Tesla fell 14% before rebounding. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has acknowledged his government has been arming a criminal gang in Gaza that's repeatedly been accused of looting humanitarian aid trucks. This comes as the new shadowy U.S.-Israeli-backed aid operation known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has suspended aid deliveries again, despite starvation spreading in Gaza. Some aid was briefly distributed Thursday. Palestinians describe risking their lives to receive a small portion of food aid.
"We died inside. We died. We died. We can't. All this to get food for our children. I got this, a bit of flour, a bit of lentils, and two packs of pasta. We died. They made us pass at the peak of the heat and they killed us. We can't walk. We can't go on."
The UN is warning acute malnutrition among Gaza's young children has soared in recent months, with more than 2,700 Palestinians under the age of five diagnosed. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has called for a halt to what it calls the relentless and systematic decimation of hospitals in Gaza, unquote. Meanwhile, a fourth journalist has died following Israel's attack on the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital. Ahmed Khalja, who worked with Al-Arabiya, is the 226th journalist killed in Gaza since 2023. Lebanon's accusing Israel of violating the ceasefire by bombing Beirut's southern suburbs on Thursday night. The attack came on the eve of Eid al-Adha holiday. It marked the fourth time Israel's attacked the Lebanese capital since the November ceasefire began. In southern France, dock workers at a port outside Marseille have refused to move military cargo bound for Israel to protest the Netanyahu government's assault on Gaza. The Secretary General of France's Trade Union Federation told reporters, quote, it is unacceptable that union dock workers should be the ones forced to uphold the fundamental principles of international law and French values. The government must immediately block all arms deliveries to the state of Israel, unquote. On Capitol Hill, nearly two dozen Congress members have co-sponsored a bill that would withhold offensive weapons from Israel. The Block the Bombs Act seeks to cut off the flow of arms that violate international law and humanitarian norms. This is Washington State Democrat Pramila Jayapal, leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
How many more children will we watch burned in flames? How much more carnage do we have to witness as the Netanyahu government uses U.S. taxpayer-funded weapons to kill Palestinians with impunity and to run roughshod over the Geneva Conventions and our own U.S. laws? How many more American-made bombs must we watch hitting hospitals, schools, shelters, indiscriminately killing aid workers, civilians, women, babies? How many more entire communities do we have to watch razed to the ground? This has to end. It is an affront to human dignity, to our collective conscience.
Congressmember Pramila Jayapal is one of the leaders of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has imposed sanctions on four judges at the International Criminal Court. It's the latest move by the U.S. to retaliate against the Hague-based court after it issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity and war crimes in Gaza. Meanwhile, Drop Site News reports a leaked State Department memo reveals the Trump administration's considering a radical restructuring of the agency that would see the consolidation or elimination of over 3,400 U.S.-based staff positions, as well as entire bureaus dedicated to conflict resolution, women's rights, public diplomacy, and humanitarian coordination. President Trump's withdrawn his nomination of Jared Isaacman to lead NASA. Isaacman's a billionaire private astronaut, close associate of Elon Musk, who's twice flown aboard SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft. His nomination had been approved by the Senate Commerce Committee, and the full Senate was set to vote on it in the coming days. This comes as the White House has proposed cutting NASA's budget by a quarter, with science programs cut nearly in half, which would lead to the cancellation of dozens of missions and thousands of layoffs. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has signed waivers to speed construction of 36 miles of new border wall in Arizona and New Mexico. In a statement, the department said Noem was exercising her authority to waive environmental laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act. Meanwhile, a Peruvian woman who was detained by U.S. Army soldiers and arrested by a Border Patrol agent in West Texas May 12th, has been acquitted of illegally entering a national defense area. Adelie Vanessa de la Cruz Alvarez already faces deportation, but could have received a prison term of up to 18 months for entering the narrow strip of land along the U.S.-Mexico border that President Trump recently transferred to the military. Nearly a dozen ICE agents have been left stranded alongside a group of eight deportees in a converted shipping container at a U.S. military base in Djibouti. That's according to an extraordinary document filed in federal court Thursday by an ICE official who writes, agents and their prisoners face risks from disease, extreme heat, poor air quality, and warnings of potential rocket attacks on the base of Yemen's Houthi fighters. The deportees arrived in Djibouti aboard a U.S. deportation flight after a federal judge ruled they could not be transferred to South Sudan, a nation on the brink of civil war, to which they are not citizens. Rather than return the deportees to the U.S. to reopen their cases, they were rerouted to Djibouti. In Massachusetts, a federal judge Thursday ordered the release of the Milford High School honors student Marcelo Gomez da Silva. Last week, immigration agents arrested the 18-year-old on his way to volleyball practice. Gomez was able to reunite with his family and friends in an emotional scene after his release on $2,000 bond. He told reporters he was confined to a windowless room holding dozens of men with no access to the outdoors, no privacy, and no shower for the entire 6 days he was jailed.
She's like, do you know why you're arrested? And I said, no, I don't. She said, because you overstayed your visa. You came here in 2013, and in 2015, you overstayed. And I told her, I was like, ma'am, I was 7 years old. Like, I don't know nothing about that stuff. Like, I don't understand how it works.
After Marcelo was detained on Saturday, on Sunday, there was graduation. He was supposed to be in the band in which he plays. After graduation, the students marched in their gowns to town hall to protest his detention. For the first time, the Trump administration's returned a wrongly deported immigrant. A Guatemalan man identified in court filings as OCG was returned to the U.S. on Wednesday following a federal judge's order to take all immediate steps to reverse his deportation to Guatemala, where he was previously held for ransom and rape. A new lawsuit alleges Colorado Governor Jared Polis collaborated with the Trump administration after it issued a secret subpoena to force Colorado officials to turn over personal information on residents sponsoring unaccompanied migrant children. According to the lawsuit, Governor Polis directed his staff to comply with the order, even though he had signed a law explicitly prohibiting such cooperation. In more news from Colorado, a federal judge Wednesday ordered the Trump administration to immediately halt deportation proceedings against the family of the Egyptian man charged in Sunday's firebombing attack in Boulder, which injured 12 people at a protest in support of Israeli hostages. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem personally announced the deportation proceedings in a video she shared on social media earlier this week.
We're also investigating to what extent his family knew about this horrific attack, if they had any knowledge of it, or if they provided support to it.
Attorneys for the wife of Mohammed Sabri Soleiman and their five children wrote in a successful lawsuit challenging their deportation, quote, "It's patently unlawful to punish individuals for the crimes of their relatives," unquote. Dozens of attorneys, law school professors, and retired Florida Supreme Court justices have filed an ethics complaint against U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi with the Florida Bar Association, accusing her of serious professional misconduct. The complaint says Bondi threatened Justice Department lawyers with discipline or termination if they failed to, quote, zealously pursue the president's political objectives, unquote. Attorney General Bondi has played a central role in the firings and resignations of numerous government lawyers during her 4 months leading the Justice Department. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with the escalating feud between President Trump and Elon Musk, the world's richest man, who up until just recently was a top presidential advisor and Trump's top political benefactor. The fight could have broad implications for Trump's presidency, the Republican Party, and many government programs, including NASA, that rely on technology from Musk's various companies. The feud became public Tuesday when Musk called Trump's so-called big, beautiful budget bill a disgusting abomination because it'll increase the federal deficit by $2.5 trillion. The tension then escalated considerably on Thursday. During a meeting with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, a reporter asked Trump about Musk's comment. This is part of his response.
But I'm very disappointed because Elon knew the inner workings of this bill better than almost anybody sitting here, better than you people. He knew everything about it. He had no problem with it. All of a sudden, he had a problem. And he only developed the problem when he found out that we're going to have to cut the EV mandate, because that's billions and billions of dollars. And it really is unfair. He knew it better than almost anybody. And he never had a problem until right after he left. And if you saw the statements he made about me, which I'm sure you can get very easily, it's very fresh on tape. He said the most beautiful things about me. And he hasn't said bad about me personally, but I'm sure that'll be next. But I'm very disappointed in Elon. I've helped Elon a lot.
The feud then spilled into social media with the two billionaires launching personal attacks on their own social media platforms, Musk on X and Trump on Truth Social. At 2:37 p.m. Thursday, Trump wrote, "Elon was wearing thin. I asked him to leave. I took away his EV mandate that forced everyone to buy electric cars that nobody else wanted, that he knew for months I was going to do, and he just went crazy," unquote. At 3:10 p.m., Musk wrote, quote, "Time to drop the really big bomb. Real Donald Trump is in the Epstein files. That's the real reason they have not been made public. Have a nice day, DJT." Then Trump wrote, "The easiest way to save money in our budget, billions and billions of dollars, is to terminate Elon's governmental subsidies and contracts. I was always surprised Biden didn't do it," Trump said. Musk responded by threatening to decommission the Dragon spacecraft used by NASA. Musk also appeared to back the impeachment of Trump and took credit for Trump winning the presidency. Trump ally Steve Bannon went further, calling for Musk to be investigated and deported. He also called for Trump to seize Musk's company, SpaceX. To talk more about the fracturing of the Trump-Musk relationship and what this could mean for the Republican Party, we're joined by Quinn Slobodian, professor of international history at Boston University, working on a book about Elon Musk titled Muskism. He is author of Hayek's Bastards, Race, Gold, IQ, and the Capitalism of the Far Right, as well as Crack-Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. Professor Slobodian, welcome back to Democracy Now! Were you shocked by what you saw happen yesterday? I mean, who knows? They could be holding a joint news conference soon and announce they're back in love.
Yeah, I mean, they are people who always have their eye on the bottom line, but they also are obviously titanically sized egos. And I think that more than anything, this is just a sign of how dangerous it is to put, you know, billions of dollars, even the lives of astronauts, the whole future of the American economy and the political scene in the hands of two sole human beings.
When you said threaten the lives of astronauts, explain.
Well, the Dragon unit that you mentioned is the only way for the astronauts in the International Space Station to get to and from where they are now. So were he to decommission it, it might literally mean that they would be stranded out there, kind of gravity style. So this is just one of the examples of many of the offloading of core government functions onto private service providers that Elon Musk has been so masterful at playing, that we feel more and more exposed to, from the use of Starlink satellites in the field of battle in the Ukraine, to the use of the same internet connection as leverage in his battle with the Brazilian government. I feel like over time we'll only realize more and more how much we are at the mercy of someone who is acting with total impetuousness and sometimes not even with his own self-interest in mind.
Let's go from the threat to lives in space to here on the ground, the Elon Musk taking on the budget, calling it an abomination. When Trump said he knows that the budget bill better than almost anyone else inside and out, Musk's response was, "That is false. I never saw it. It was passed in the middle of the night." Can you talk about the significance? I mean, this is the guy in charge of Doge. How many thousands of jobs have been lost? And yet at the same time now, he's viciously attacking the budget that was so narrowly passed, and it could threaten its ultimate passage.
I mean, I think it's worth sort of returning to the question of why Musk got involved at all with Trump, right? What he was doing with this Doge project. And I think it's possible to kind of split it up into three categories. I think, first of all, he was doing a kind of a bear hug strategy. So I think especially on the trade war and his many, many interests in China, you know, he has a gigafactory there that has capacity to make a million Teslas a year. He wanted to get out in front of any possible excessive economic nationalism that might be rolled out. And then I think he was kind of making a Hail Mary move that, you know, he hadn't really clicked with the Biden administration, and this could be a chance to maybe use a window of opportunity to boost his own aspirations, especially in artificial intelligence, where he was being outpaced by people like Sam Altman and OpenAI. And then third, I think you could see it as a kind of moonshot strategy, where I think he was trying to really even more plug in his own services, especially SpaceX, to in fact not only get to the moon, but divert the whole project towards Mars. So there was a lot of reasons why Musk would want to be involved. But from Trump's point of view, I mean, he's never really been a fiscal hawk, right? He's always actually run against austerity in certain ways and run against this mainstream obsession with the debt ceiling and the deficit that has so defined GOP politics for the last couple decades. So it was always kind of an odd fit. And it's not surprising in that sense that Musk now feels that this budget is, you know, not hard austerity enough for his liking. It's telling, for example, that he's posted multiple Milton Friedman memes over the last couple of days, sort of implying that this problem of runaway debt, inflation, should be top of mind at all times for the government. But Trump has always profited by playing fast and loose with that kind of ideology. And the question is, why now has this led to a snapping point for Musk? And I think there's a...
Keep going.
If I could just say, I think there's a couple of things there. I think Trump invokes the EV mandate, and that is a serious issue, right? What that is and needs to be broken down is the capacity of California to enforce a move towards electric cars over time, a part of which is a regulatory credit system that allows normal ICE, internal combustion engine vehicles, to buy credits from electric vehicle manufacturers. And this is now 40% of Tesla's net income in the last year. It went up $1 billion in the last year alone. And if that gets killed, it really does kind of kill Tesla's margin. And I think that Musk is starting to feel the heat from Chinese producers like BYD, battery producers like CATL. And I think he sees here maybe the possible demise of the Tesla brand as he is hated more and more from both sides of the spectrum. So there's reasons as he returns to his businesses to start to sweat about what he's actually signed up for.
How about what this highlights around a rift within the MAGA movement and where J.D. Mm-hmm. Vance fits into this, the vice president?
Well, it's always interesting to ask what exactly was going on with Doge, right? I mean, if you want to get into the real kind of dangerous liaisons, sort of courtesanship, I think that was happening inside of the White House. It seems that, based on reporting, Stephen Miller was kind of stage managing, along with his wife, a lot of what was happening with Doge. And if you look at what actually came out of Doge, and this is a good time now for us to sort of do a autopsy or postmortem on it as it winds down, really. He said he was going to do $2 trillion in cuts out of a $6 trillion budget. Very unlikely. Went back to $1 trillion. Scaled it back to $150 billion. What did they end up taking out? I mean, it's basically culture war stuff, right? I mean, it's ways to trigger the progressives and the libs, get rid of U.S. aid, attack NEH funding, arts funding, science funding, education, energy. These ended up being big wins, not really for Musk's own bottom line cost-cutting mentality, but very much for the culture war being waged by people like Miller and J.D. Vance and Russell Vought at the Office of Management of Budget. So there is a way of looking at this as having been a success from their point of view. They were able to use the credibility of Musk as a kind of supposed, brilliant Edison-like inventor and wonderful, efficiency-creating cost cutter to actually get to some of their political goals. But they never could bring that big number down. Why? Because entitlement spending still dominates the state spending in the GDP. And when you come close to that, you come close to the kind of beating heart of the social contract. And we saw the town hall meetings, we saw the anger when things started to encroach on the questions of Social Security and Medicaid. And for me, that was a very telling moment. And it was one that I think took Musk by surprise, too. He's not used to the idea of needing to engage with a kind of consent and legitimacy mechanism where people feel like they paid into something and should now get something back. He's used to interacting with a Twitter fan base, a set of really bought-in Tesla investors for whom, you know, he always walks on water and he's a god reincarnate. And when he just was confronted with the anger of average people who want to make sure that they can pay for their next meal, he didn't know what to do. So I think that there's a kind of a there's a way to see this as a victory for the national conservatives. They got to do some of their easy wins against the progressives and the libs, and now they're able to keep the door open for more protectionism and expansion of spending, as we see in the so-called big beautiful bill.
Finally, do you think Musk has access to all of the private information that his Doge army downloaded from all the agencies? Is that possible?
I am not a software programmer, or I do not know how databases work that well, but it seems at least likely that part of what they were doing there when they were converting things done in old programming languages and updating them was also, you know, harvesting a lot of that data for use for we don't know what, feeding the machine of Grok or XAI is the most likely answer.
And finally, let me ask you, Steve Bannon, who's on the anti-Musk side of the MAGA rift, has been calling for Trump to nationalize Musk's businesses and for him to be deported, right? I mean, Elon Musk comes from South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, this actually isn't the harshest thing that Bannon has ever said. He referred to Silicon Valley as an apartheid state a few months ago. The idea of nationalizing SpaceX is an interesting one. It would certainly run against the core privatization ethos that Trump and the former GOP has been following for decades and decades. So far, I would chalk that up to just saber-rattling rhetoric for his podcast more than an actual policy proposal.
Quinn Slobodian, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of international history at Boston University, among other books, Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy, working on his new book called Muskism. When we come back, we look at the deadly impact of the House budget bill. Back in 20 seconds.
¿Por qué me temes? Si soy fruto de algo que no tiene nombre, el error que no comete nunca el hombre. ¿Por qué me temes? ¿Por qué me temes? Si estoy hecha para estar arrepentida. Y mi historia se ha quedado ya sin vida. ¿Por qué me temes?
Temes by Ilay, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Congressional Budget Office projects 16 million people could lose health care coverage under the cuts to Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act and Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, now before the Senate passed by the House, which also includes massive tax handouts for billionaires. This comes as public health experts warn the proposed cuts could lead to more than 50,000 preventable deaths each year in the U.S. For more, we're joined by one of those experts, Allison Galvani. She is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Modeling and Analysis at Yale School of Public Health, where she also holds an endowed chair in epidemiology. She's part of a group of public health experts at Yale and the University of Pennsylvania who sent a letter this week to Senate Finance Committee ranking members Ron Wyden and Bernie Sanders, warning about the impact of these provisions. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Professor. If you can start off by talking about exactly what you found. We are talking about real lives, not concepts, not policy fights, when it comes to this budget bill that the Senate is now weighing.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for having me again. So the bill proposes deep cuts to Medicaid, imposes onerous paperwork, and fails to safeguard health care tax credits. As you mentioned, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that these rollbacks would cause 16 million Americans to lose their insurance. Exacerbating the crisis, nursing homes will also become less safe by rescinding staffing members. Nurses will lose their jobs, and patients will suffer. Seniors will also be impacted by the elimination of current prescription subsidies. So altogether, we projected that these retractions would precipitate more than 51,000 unnecessary deaths annually.
So if you can talk more about what exactly, we have two different issues. One is the budget and what this will mean, for example, around Medicaid and the triggering of Medicare cuts, food assistance. Talk particularly where the worst, what you see as the worst cuts will be. And then I want to talk about at the same time, these massive cuts to grants from the NIH, from the National Institutes of Health, that are shutting down everything from cancer research to investigating Alzheimer's and other issues.
Well, one of the worst cuts to Medicaid is going to be the requirement. It's called the work requirement. But the problem is, and we've seen this implemented at state levels with terrible failure, to implement an aspect like that on the ground, it requires the government to have many more employees. So that's the taxpayers paying for that. It's actually an inefficiency. Going through the paperwork, people who are working a lot, you know, most people on Medicaid actually are working, but they will need to then prove that they're working, filling out forms, et cetera. And it's been found, like there's an example in New Hampshire where they tried to implement something like this. There was an enormous exodus out of their healthcare. Because, and then when they looked at who was leaving, those people were eligible for healthcare. They were working, but they just were having trouble being aware and navigating the labyrinth of bureaucratic paperwork.
As the whole debate goes on, there's very little mention of Medicare for All. You address this in your letter to Senator Sanders, who is a lead proponent of universal health care. Even the Democrats are not raising it. And yet this clearly would be a massive solution and cost-saving, life-saving solution.
Yeah, absolutely. As you just said, to put this into context, we previously demonstrated that expanding health care to all Americans would save more than 68,000 lives, save more than 68,000 lives. So in other words, the difference between this bill and the Medicare for All Act amounts to 119,000 lives every year, conservatively. I think our parameters are quite conservative, but almost 120,000 people being saved every year. So this, and by the way, when we looked at the financial aspects of that, it saves money because a single payer universal system makes the implementation of healthcare vastly more efficient. So there are a lot of ways we can improve how expensive our healthcare is, but taking healthcare away from people is not how to do it. I think our research underscores the insidious public health ramifications of the proposed legislation.
And finally, the massive cuts to research into diseases in this country. The U.S. is seen as the gem, the center of research. Now, well over 1,000 grants have been shut down.
Yes, very dismaying. So science used to be a nonpartisan issue. You know, everyone across the political ideology benefits from medical advances and medical innovations. And it's disheartening that public health has become so politically polarized. The research funding cuts will hinder advancements in medical innovations, including cancer therapies and treatments for infectious disease, just to name a couple.
Alison Galvani, we're going to, of course, continue to cover this. Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Modeling and Analysis at Yale School of Public Health, where she also holds an endowed chair in epidemiology. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, Immigration and Customs Enforcement reported since President Trump took office in January, CBS News reports new data it obtained shows ICE agents have arrested more than 100,000 people. Conditions at the ICE-run Chrome Detention Center in Miami are so crowded that on Thursday, news helicopters filmed about 100 people held there as they formed the letters SOS and the Spanish word for free, libre. This comes as Newark, New Jersey Mayor Roz Baraka on Tuesday sued President Trump's acting U.S. attorney for the state of New Jersey after ICE agents arrested him last month outside the newly opened ICE jail run by GEO Group called Delaney Hall in Newark. Mayor Baraka was there with three Democratic members of Congress from New Jersey for an oversight tour, their responsibility. The complaint also names a special agent with the Department of Homeland Security's Investigations Unit as a co-defendant, Ricky Patel. Trump's Justice Department is suing Newark over its sanctuary policies, along with three other New Jersey cities, including Jersey City, where the mayor, Steve Fulop, is also running for governor. Newark Mayor Roz Baraka is also running for governor. The primary is Tuesday, June 10th. Mayor Baraka joins us now in our studio for an update. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We spoke to you soon after your arrest, but we didn't speak to you after you filed suit. Talk about who the U.S. attorney, Alina Hubba, is and exactly what happened on that day that you were arrested, Mayor.
Right. Alina Hubba is the U.S. attorney. She's the interim U.S. attorney, used to be Trump's personal lawyer. She's the U.S. attorney now, for a few more months. She came into New Jersey threatening the governor, threatening the attorney general, saying she's going to turn our state red. All of these things that have nothing to do with the U.S. attorney's job whatsoever. I went down there for a press event. I've been down there since and before that many times, to make sure that they were, in fact, in compliance with our local and state laws, uniform code construction laws, that they, in fact, had a certificate of occupancy. And we're still in court battling about that, in fact. But, ultimately, they made a decision to arrest me down there unlawfully.
And explain what happened, where the Congress members were. Ultimately, Congressmember MacGyver has now been charged.
Right.
But explain why you were there, how you'd gone from the, was it private property of GEO Group over to the Newark side where
right.
you're mayor?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what happened. I mean, I was allowed in to the property by the GEO Group. The ICE agents came. Well, they were there for a long time. The bosses came and decided that they wanted me off the property. And, they told me to leave. I left ultimately. And when I got outside, they made a decision to arrest me anyway.
Where does Ricky Patel fit into this, and who is he?
He's a special agent in charge of Homeland Security in that area, investigating.
This is HSI, Homeland Security Investigations. It's
right.
hard to tell the difference between the ICE agents,
right.
HSI.
It is. But they're all part of the same conundrum. But at the end of the day, yeah, he's the special agent in charge. It would be like me sending my police director downtown Newark to arrest somebody for shoplifting. He came. He's the boss. He probably haven't arrested anybody in God knows how long. He came there and arrested me on federal trespass. There's no such thing as federal trespass. Trespassing is a state charge, first of all, and was not on federal property either. So all of this stuff is false in the first place. And I didn't kick my way in. As you can see, I walked in. And so they had no grounds.
You've been there a number of times
yeah.
before.
At least
what do you see as your responsibility as mayor in dealing with Delaney Hall, which has gone from being a halfway house to a major ICE jail?
Well, like any other, development project or project in the city, they have to follow city ordinances. They need uniform code construction inspections. They need fire inspections, health inspections, and they need to change the use of the property. Through a certificate of occupancy. They can't go into any property without a certificate of occupancy, not even a temporary one, a TCO, that allows us to come in and make sure they're using the building based on what they say. When our folks first went down there, they wouldn't allow them in. I didn't believe it. I said, I have to go with you. I want to see if this is real. And we went down there, and they actually refused entry to inspectors, which never, ever, ever happens. You know, the inspectors have a right to come into your property, especially the health and fire inspector. They have a right to come to the property and inspect it.
So Elena Hubba, the former personal lawyer for Trump, escalated. When you were charged, you went to court. She didn't drop the charges. She said she's taking this to trial.
Yeah, well, that was the intent. You know, they sat there in the hearing. First, you know, it was a preliminary hearing. They didn't want the preliminary hearing, interesting enough, because they said the charge was too minor. It wasn't too minor for me to be fingerprinted and mugshotted and interrogated. I mean, so they went through the whole process, and because they didn't have any evidence, they dropped it.
So why are you suing?
Because they arrested me without any evidence. Like the judge said, they arrested me as a preliminary investigation. You investigate first, then make an arrest. You don't arrest people, then investigate it. I mean, that's exactly what happened. And they fingerprinted me. They took a mugshot. I mean, they did it twice. Once up one time when I got arrested, and the other time when I was in court. You know, I think it was overkill. Something of that small. I should have got a blue summons. They could have mailed that to my house and told me to appear in court for some kind of violation, but they humiliated me, they cuffed me, they dragged me in the car, took me to the cell. They did all of these things that wasn't warranted. It was completely unwarranted.
Meanwhile, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, is suing four cities. You're a sanctuary city in Newark.
Right.
So what are you doing about that? And also, you're running for governor, so you're you would be in charge of all the cities.
A lot of distraction there. We are partnering with other cities to mount a collective defense against what's happening. Other cities have had this issue and have defended themselves successfully. The higher court has already opined on this, said that states and cities do not have to enforce these kind of immigration laws. We do not have to help ICE do this. So, and we're not obstructing them. We're not standing in their way. We're not stopping them from kidnapping people off the street for unjustly violating people's constitutional rights. They're doing that anyway, despite what we say and do. So ultimately, this is a frivolous case and a waste of taxpayers' money.
So why are you running for governor? We just have 30 seconds, but the primary is Tuesday. You've been endorsed by Working Families Party, Make the Road Action New Jersey, Rutgers AAUP, AFT Union, Service Employees Union, among others.
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity for us to build a lab of democracy in the state of New Jersey, to build a broad-based coalition, to fight for things that we think are important. And I think now, in this moral moment that we're in, we have a kind of obligation to do the things that we only talk about, like that we discuss in our private meetings, that the discussion that you guys were having earlier about a single payer system, about public option in New Jersey, an opportunity to create a public bank that invests in black and brown communities and economically distressed neighborhoods, to lower healthcare costs, right, to make housing affordable, to establish statewide rent controls. These are things that need to happen to make people's lives better. To make sure that the Democrats govern for working class families and not for the wealthy or the super wealthy, to distinguish us from Republicans or everybody else, for that matter, to build a democracy that's enviable across this country. Something I think California was trying to do for a minute, that they're backing up off of. And so we have the room to step into that space right now and tell the rest of the country what needs to happen.
Roz Baraka, I want to thank you for being with us. Mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Democratic candidate for governor. The primary election is this Tuesday, June 10th. And he has sued the acting U.S. attorney who had him arrested as he tried to inspect the detention jail in his city of Newark. Next up, we get an update from the Freedom Flotilla boat heading to Gaza. And we'll speak to a doctor suing University of California, San Francisco, after she was fired talking about Gaza. Stay with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta para acá tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega. El tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento se entrega.
Llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega. El tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan. En tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo suelta. En tu pecho una llamada que todo lo quema.
Me está llamando.
Óyelo.
Me está llamando.
Un fuego que todo lo quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Responde que te está llamando, responde que te está, llamando.
Está llamando.
Un fuego que por donde quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema, un fuego que todo
me
lo quema.
Llamando.
Blame by Mako Sound System in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We go to get an update from the Freedom Flotilla boat, the Madeleine, sailing to Gaza with vital humanitarian aid. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition initially planned to sail from Malta last month, but their ship was damaged after it was bombed by drones in international waters. Earlier this week, the Madeleine received a Mayday call directing them to a boat that was rapidly deflating with about 30 to 40 migrants on board. For more, we go to the Freedom Flotilla, where we're joined by Thiago Avila. He's a Brazilian activist and steering committee member of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. He's among 12 activists sailing to Gaza. The mission also includes the renowned Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, whom we spoke to earlier this week. Thiago, welcome to Democracy Now! Israel has threatened to raid your ship. We know what happened to the Mavi Marmara more than a decade ago when the Israeli military raided the ship and killed 9 people on board. Where are you now in the sea? What's happened with these migrants? And how do you plan to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza?
Thank you so much for having the Freedom Flotilla here on Democracy Now! For us, it's an honor. You do a very important work. We are here somewhere in the Mediterranean, actually 500 nautical miles from Gaza. If we would go to the north, we'll be going to Crete in Greece. If we would go to south, we would be going to Egypt right now. And we are on the sixth day of a journey that will end on Monday, likely on the morning, to get to Gaza. That's our estimated time of arrival. And we are right now with 12 people, with spirits are high, and we are carrying life-saving aid, food, medicine, crutches, prosthetics for amputated children, water filters. And we're doing our best here to be useful for the Solidarity Movement for Palestine. We are a nonviolent direct action mission that not only wants to break the siege, the illegal siege that Israel has put Gaza for 18 years, but also wants to create a people's humanitarian corridor so that all countries, all organizations, institutions, and the social majorities of the world can help and can be in support of the Palestinian people. People cannot stand anymore seeing children starving to death, and it's in their hearts the idea of doing something, and we're part of this doing something collectively with all the demonstrations, all the global uprising, dock workers blocking the cargo vessels to Israel, so many people doing amazing things, disrupting arms factories, creating, breaking the media blockade and spreading true information about the genocide of 8 decades. So we're part of the same thing. And yesterday we received a Mayday call from a boat that was rapidly deflating. And we managed to rescue four of these people. Unfortunately, the rest has been taken and illegally deported back to Libya from Libyan so-called Coast Guard. But the four of the ones that we managed to rescue, they were sent to the Coast Guard, and we are asking for refugee for them in Greece. So this was something that happened that we did not expect. We sailed for 2.5 hours doing search and rescue operation, despite the fact that only a few of our members here are trained in search and rescue operation, but life comes first. So we changed our course completely yesterday to do and attend to this Mayday call. And in the end, we did what we could, and we were very happy that we managed to rescue 4 people from the water. And the Mediterranean being on the water means death very, very fast. So we're glad that we did.
Thiago, we just have another minute, but I wanted to ask you about Latin American solidarity with Gaza. You're a Brazilian activist. Why you decided to come from Brazil?
Yes. Oh, I come from a place where imperialism always plays a decisive role. My country suffered 2 two military coups, and both of them had the support of the United States. And so it's important that we understand that imperialism and Zionism, they are the greatest evils of our generation, and we need to defeat them wherever we can. And Palestine is now the strategic place for all peoples to unite and fight against oppression, exploitation, and the destruction of nature. But they have been threatening us for many, many years. For 17 years, any flotilla mission that tried to reach Gaza has been threatened by them. But we will not bow to their threats. We do not need their permission. This is international waters, and we're going to Palestinian territorial waters. So we're going not with their permission, but with the help of millions and billions of people that know that starving children to death is wrong, that bombing hospitals, shelters, and schools is wrong, and that's what we are counting on. They cannot defeat us by force. If they attack us, we'll have thousands of people on the next flotilla, and they will understand, like all oppressive regimes understand in the end, that they cannot beat the people's true force, that people's power is the ultimate power, and love and solidarity can beat any hateful, racist, and supremacist ideology like Zionism.
And if Israel raids your boat, they have pledged not to allow the ship to dock or to even approach Gaza, Thiago.
Yes, they did this before, like you mentioned, 15 years ago. They killed executed nine of our participants, and another 10 died 6 months later. And 1 month ago, they just bombed our boats, and they've been sending drones every night here for 3 nights in a row. So we can expect violence from them. And we do our preparations. We train our participants in nonviolent direct action so that even facing extreme violence, we remain nonviolent, because there's no military victory for us here. We're a humble boat, 12 people, that 80 meters boat. So we only can win through solidarity, making sure that the whole world knows that Gaza has been under siege for 18 years, living eight decades of genocide and ethnic cleansing. And this is how we also move the structures for a safe passage. So spreading the word of what we're doing guarantees us a safe passage, because if they understand that they cannot afford to attack us, and that will be even worse for them in the attack, we have a chance.
Thiago Avila, we want to thank you for being with us. All safety to you. Brazilian activists among 12 activists sailing to Gaza to deliver humanitarian aid on the Madeleine ship, named for the first Gazan fisherwoman. The ship launched by the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. You can also see our interview with Greta Thunberg, also on that boat at democracynow.org. We end today's show with Dr. Rupa Marya, renowned physician, activist, author, composer, who this week filed two free speech complaints against University of California, San Francisco. One is a First Amendment lawsuit accusing the university of violating her constitutional rights to free speech. The other, a civil rights lawsuit for discrimination on the basis of speech in support of Palestinian rights and the rights of all marginalized people to have fair access to health care. Dr. Marya alleges that UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, began targeting her long before she began to speak out about Palestine, as her work centers research into the impacts of colonialism and structural racism in healthcare. Joining us now from San Francisco, co-author of the book Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Dr. Marya, thanks for being with us. Explain these two lawsuits and what happened to you. When were you fired?
I was fired in May. Happy to be here again. Thank you, Amy. I was fired in May last month for, you know, I didn't expect that my career-ending move would be to say stop bombing hospitals, for expressing support for Palestinian liberation and for criticizing the U.S.-backed genocide in Israel. And so, you know, when this firing came after months-long of repression, harassment, intimidation, defamation in coordination with California State Senator Scott Wiener. UCSF leadership has been egregiously repressing healthcare workers, firing, suspending, harassing for 20 months. And so it is time to fight back, because we cannot do our jobs without our voices. Doctors need our voices. Our healthcare workers need our voices to advocate for the health of all people. And that is what I have done for the 24 years of my work as a doctor, and that is what I will continue to do. And so it's critical to understand, why is it that UCSF is trying to stop healthcare workers from speaking up for the rights of health for all?
So when were you fired, and on what grounds?
I was fired May 20th after a several months long faculty conduct process. I was suspended first, and they attacked my medical license. They defamed me publicly. So all sorts of horrible activity happened for the last 20 months as I was advocating for the rights of Palestinians who are facing genocide.
Can you talk about threats that you received?
Oh, horrible threats. So when UCSF, in coordination with California State Scott Weiner, started publishing defamatory statements about me across multiple social media sites, I received death threats, horrific racist death threats, rape threats. I had, you know, faculty members tell me that they were being asked to fill out false reports of my bad clinical behavior, which, you know, in 23 years of practice, I've had no incidents of patient safety issues. So these are the kinds of things that also ended up leading me on an investigation to understand what these relationships were between Scott Weiner and UCSF. And I learned that UCSF's largest donor, the Diller Foundation, the billionaire Diller family, donates to the whole UC system, donates to California State Senator Scott Weiner, and also donates to the, or has donated to the Canary Mission, which I landed on due to these events. The Canary Mission is a doxing, malicious website that has ties to the Israeli government that the Trump administration is currently using to as a list of people to deport, the students to deport across the United States.
You asked the university to protect you?
I did. So in 2020, I also received threats as I was writing my book, Inflamed, with Raj Patel, and I was speaking out about COVID and our need to protect the most vulnerable people during, the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And at that time, UCSF's head of security, the office of the president of the UC system, the vice chancellor, Kathleen Lucy, met with me in person to describe the risks, what kinds of records requests they were getting, how they were, a concern to my personal safety and security. So at that time, they were very proactive of protecting my safety. But when these things happened in November of 2023, when I said stop bombing hospitals and started getting a barrage of online threats, UCSF didn't respond when I asked for help. And that was very interesting to me. It took them about 10 days to respond. And when they finally did respond to my request for them to take down my public profile, they told me that I was under investigation for my protected speech.
So finally, in this last minute, why two lawsuits? Explain the difference.
Well, they're just different lawsuits covering different aspects, but both of them are looking to get accountability from UCSF and also to push back so that healthcare workers can have our collective voice to speak up for the rights of Palestinians facing genocide. It is our moral and professional obligation to speak out about children being harmed in the ways that they are in Gaza, about hospitals and the whole healthcare structure being destroyed in Gaza, and about our healthcare colleagues who have been abducted, tortured, and killed in Gaza.
Dr. Maria,
we cannot be silent. We must push back.
Dr. Maria, you were named one of the top 20 most influential women in biomedicine by Nature. You've served on multiple national advisory boards, but that didn't shield you from institutional reprisal. And since your firing, over 1,000 healthcare workers and students have signed open letters demanding your reinstatement, denouncing UCF's suppression of political expression. In this last 20 seconds, what does this kind of support mean? And do you think you might be reinstated?
Solidarity is the only thing we have. It's our superpower to fight authoritarianism, fascism, and this kind of racist repression. So I ask for all healthcare workers around the world to stand in solidarity with me, because my fight is our fight, and our fight is for the liberation of Palestine and our collective liberation. Thank you.
Dr. Rupa Maria, physician, activist, author, and composer, fired in late May by the University of California, San Francisco, now filed a First Amendment lawsuit against UCSF as well. ¶¶